Hello and welcome to Eclectic Waffle, the podcast with one theme only: interesting conversations with interesting people about interesting things. I'm your host, Tom, and it's very nice to have you here. Welcome back, and sorry I've been away for some time. I guess I had a flurry of activity at the start, and it's rather tailed off. Bit of a spanner in the works. I recorded the start of an interview with a friend who's going to be great, but the Wi-Fi broke down and we had to abandon it. I think I'll be able to rescue what we did and add it on to something else, but we'll need to find a new way of recording the rest of our conversation. So that sort of stopped me, and yeah, life gets in the way a bit, doesn't it? Although that's never really a very good excuse when you're doing something important, particularly when the tools for that thing are readily available, as they really are with podcasting now, thanks to modern technology. I've been musing a bit today, back to some semblance of a social life, which is great. I went to a responsible, socially distanced party on Saturday and saw friends, which was lovely. And today went to my local pub, and that was also great. But, you know, I've been reflecting and realised actually I'm not really very happy. I'm really not very happy, and that matters. It matters to me, and I think it matters to other people who care about me, and probably a broader circle of people than just those who care about me, because it's good to meet the world as the best possible version of yourself, and that's hard to do when you're not happy. A lot of people talk about not being happy. A lot of people whine and bleat and moan, and the old wisdom is so often true, isn't it, that there's a lot to be said for thinking about those less fortunate than yourself. There's a lot to be said for not philosophizing, but working out how to fix a problem. And I think there is a particular reluctance people can have sometimes to be told, look, there is a way out of this. They can be quite irritable with people who, rather than just kind of emoting, rather than just saying there, actually say, well, you know, how about this? This could actually fix it. And there may be occasionally a place for wallowing, but when you seek someone's help, it's not then. Express yourself by all means, but if they have some good practical advice, and you've thought about it and you think that it has merit, then for goodness sake, follow it, because there's no merit in being, and there's no honour in being unhappy and in a bad place if you can be happy and get yourself into a good place. The sheer scale of my advantages in life is absolutely enormous. I have a family that loves me very much. I live somewhere very nice. I don't enjoy my job, but I have a job and it's pretty well paid. I have a decent brain. I have a nice face. And I'm reasonably tall. And let's face it, that makes a big difference in life if you're a man. But I'm just very, very unfulfilled and feeling completely trapped. I feel trapped in the career I'm in, that I don't know how to get the things I'd like to do. And there's just a general melancholy as well. I don't know if any of you feel that. Just a kind of sadness. It's funny, you know, I don't think that I'm a jealous person. And people close to me have given me that compliment, and it's a nice compliment and it's reassuring. I don't think I resent other people's success. When it's people I care about, I'm delighted. The whole Gore Vidal approach, it's not enough to succeed, others must fail, is not how I feel. And although it's occasionally galling if someone one hates seems to be having a good life in good times, I don't think I particularly obsess on that. You know, it doesn't matter if someone I doesn't like has a good life, if I can have a good one too. But you know, I'm not really crushing it. I'm not really getting it done, and I'm not actually entirely sure why. I do feel that in terms of my career, I haven't been met halfway. I thought when I went to Oxford that I'd always have a job and never struggle to find a job, and that hasn't proven to be the case at all. And I also thought that if I worked hard and did good work, then yeah, I'd get chances and opportunities and breaks, and don't really feel that that's happened very much. Not really. I've done a lot of stuff that are beneath my abilities. That's part of it. Another thing is that my own desires and dreams have become a little bit opaque. In the last year or so, I, for some time, had thought really that stand-up comedy was the thing. Listening to this, you're probably thinking, dear God, did you? You sound about as well-suited to stand-up comedy as you would be to being a National Hunt jockey. But there was some reason to suppose that that was a realistic proposition. But I'm rather out of love with stand-up. Much more absorbed by music. But there's just a kind of ennui that has rather enveloped me. So there's that. Also, I'm very overweight, and it's proving really hard to tackle that. It's an interesting thing. In some ways, received wisdom about being overweight is absolutely correct, and I would be the first to agree with that, that all these fad diets and philosophizing about it and sort of theories, political theories about people being overweight, they all obfuscate and hide a central truth, which is that you've just got to burn more calories than you take in and then you will lose weight. You know, all these kind of notions of a glandular problem or all of that kind of stuff, they don't really cut the mustard. There are, however, aspects of the politics around being overweight that are just not true and not fair. First of all, the people who point the finger are never people, ever, who are willing to address the flaws in themselves. The thing about being overweight is, rather than wearing your heart on your sleeve, you're wearing one of your frailties on your sleeve. But everyone who's ever mocked me for being overweight or criticised me for it has always been conspicuous as someone who wasn't willing to face up to their own flaws. More than that, a lot of what gets described as gluttony, I think, is something very different. People who are desperately underweight are not understood as they should be, but I think there is a kind of vague understanding in society that if someone's anorexic, something's probably gone badly wrong. I think people have an understanding that quite often it's a sexual, psychosexual problem. Not invariably, but sometimes. And that either that or something else has led someone to seriously underfeed themselves. There's no recognition at all that I can see that similar things can be going on with people who are really overweight. It's seen entirely as a function of greed and gluttony and laziness. That isn't true. The idea that that is invariably true is utterly, utterly wrong. It's morally wrong, and it's intellectually incurious, and it's unjust, but, you know, above all, it's just not true. It's not accurate. It's not an accurate reading of the situation. My eating has improved considerably. I still have bad habits, and I still need to nail down my diet, but the 18 months, 2 years ago, and for several years before that, before I finally escaped London and managed to get a little bit more on the straight and narrow, my out of control eating was nothing to do with satiating myself. It was nothing to do with pleasure. I would sit there eating thinking, why am I doing this? And why am I carrying on? And why do I know I'm going to carry on? And I don't want to. That wasn't greed. It was utter desperation. And people seem to have no real understanding of that. I mean, I'm luckier than many people in my situation because I'm a big strapping man. Now, unfortunately, that's one of the reasons I'm so heavy, because as well as being really overweight, I'm also heavily muscled and I'm also really big boned. And so I'm kind of, all three, basically, all three things that can lead you to being heavy, I have. Before I was overweight, I was always much heavier than I looked. And then years of weight training put on more muscle, and overeating got on muscle as well, because your body grows to accommodate yourself. Your muscles grow to accommodate your excess weight. But because I'm a big strapping guy, not many people will say abusive things. People might make a joke that they sort of think is gentle and friendly and all good banter. And occasionally people have shouted things. But broadly speaking, I don't get much of that, whereas women get it all the time. Women, of course, get remarks about their appearance and unkind remarks about their appearance, whatever their size, and not always are these comments about their size. It can be about their face or other aspects of how they look. So I'm much, much luckier on that front. Also, I do genuinely not care that much what people think if I don't respect them. That's a quality I've developed over the years, and it's stood me in good stead. I think it enabled me to be able to do stand-up comedy and to have a reasonably thick skin, and it helps me have a straight head and a clear head on things. That kind of bullshit of worrying what people who I don't respect think is a really helpful quality. But nevertheless, it is something that is a factor in my life, and the very fact of being so big is a factor, and it is a handicap. I mean literally that it is a handicap. I'm not saying that I am handicapped or that I am disabled. I think when you're sort of talking about it as a disability in a completely passive way, then you're making a big mistake. I think these things are less in one's control than some people think they are. But also, it would be a huge mistake, both as a matter of fact and as a matter of strategy, to say, well, this is something I can't do anything about, because that isn't true. It's all, of course, also a matter of wrong thinking. It is thinking errors that lead people to overeat. It's thinking errors that lead people to do things that they know are not actually in their best interests. Food has an addictive quality. It gives you a dopamine hit and all of that. And it can be very nice in terms of texture, and tastes can invoke happy memories, and eating out can be a really nice communal thing and a great experience. But there are also thinking errors. I know I can lose weight, but I certainly lose sight of that fact on a regular basis and will cease to believe, fail to believe that I can get things done. And sometimes it seems like such a huge task, it seems impossible and depressing, and then the cycle begins again. So I kind of feel that I'm going through life with the equivalent of a big carbuncle on my face. That's how it feels. I feel ugly and frustrated because I also feel not at all ugly. I look at myself in the mirror sometimes and think, dear God, what a curate's egg you are. You are terribly, terribly overweight. And yet, underneath all that, because obviously I know my naked body reasonably well, underneath all that is already a magnificent physique. It's not like some people who have to sort of trim themselves down and then build themselves up. You know, I'm not skinny fat. I'm massive fat. there is lurking under all this very broad-shouldered, astonishingly broad-shouldered, heavily muscled man. And as my excellent personal trainer has pointed out, my body has grown to sort of accommodate my extra weight, and so I now have very strong connective tissues and muscles and all of that. And it's just a question of getting out of the marble, a bit like Michelangelo with his statue of David. It is in there. It's in there already. There's nothing I need to add at all. I just need to remove all the excess. But it's all bound up in really painful emotional stuff that people will never understand. People don't know what OCD is. They think it's all about neatness and order and germs. And then when it comes to the people whose version of OCD is about those things, they've no idea how distressing it is for them. I don't particularly have a germ phobia. I like things to be reasonably neat. It's a preference, but I wouldn't say I have. My liking for neatness is a manifestation of my OCD at all. But I've got friends for whom that is the case, and it causes them immense distress. But people don't know. They don't know what it's like to live with intrusive thoughts and embarrassing compulsions, and just for the howling agony that all that can bring, and the years of guilt from which I finally started to emerge, but emerging with a load of bad habits in tow that I developed as a coping mechanism. And so it does bother me a bit that people sort of think, oh, he's lazy, oh, he's greedy. You know, I have my faults. God knows I have my faults. I can be impatient. I'm not always kind. I can get verbally quite aggressive sometimes. I can be boring. But you know what? In a way, the things I get the most stick for are the things I don't feel guilty about. On a rational level, when I'm able to be rational about it. It's not my fault I have OCD. And although I have failed to tackle my weight, and I have to own that, to use modern parlance, I need to own that, it is much more complex than people will realise. At the same time, it's really important not to lose sight of the ancient wisdoms. That, you know, you do need to look at things very, very basically. It's a bit like with depression, you know. Depression is so much more complex than we used to realise. And yet it does remain the case that trying to forget about yourself, trying to absorb yourself in a project, trying to be busy, going out and exercising, that really helps. So the whole sort of stiff upper lip, look, just get on with it approach actually is quite good advice. Certainly as a coping mechanism there on that day when you're struggling. It may be that you also need to do some cognitive behavioural therapy. Maybe work with a psychiatrist in some cases. And sometimes acknowledge your feelings, because that's important too. But just taking the old-fashioned approach has its merits too, and that's also true with this. I need to exercise. I need to exercise. I need to eat less, and I need to eat better. That's all true. And the fact that it is all much more complex and has not been as in my control and is not the moral failing that I for so long have thought it was, that doesn't mean there isn't a route out, and I've got to find that route out. At the same time, I think there's an assumption that everything wrong with my life is about my weight. And of course, that's not true either. I think a lot of people feel that if I was trimmer, I'd have had more success in my career. Do you know what? I think that's almost no factor whatsoever. I don't think people do particularly care what men look like in the professional environments which I've been in. I've struggled to be smartly dressed at times, partly because of being big, but actually once I've had some beautiful suits made and tailor-made shirts, that all goes out the window and I can look as smart as anyone else. And again, the pressures are not the same on men as they are on women to look nice. The only advantage women have is much more leeway as to what they're allowed to wear. I know sometimes people find women find that a burden that they have too many choices, but I think it'd be nice to have broader scope to dress in a variety of ways in an office environment. It is quite ironic that I'd be absolutely fine if I wanted to turn up to work in a dress. But jeans and a t-shirt would not be acceptable. But there you go. So yeah, no, the career stuff I think is about something else entirely. It's frankly not always having had my abilities recognised, and that's partly a product of what I've done, which is writing. I think people who are not good with numbers tend to know that and tend to defer to those who are. Lots of people fancy themselves wordsmiths and writers, and they're not. And they don't recognise quality. They don't recognise that some people are better at it than others. And then they weigh in and they try and change everything you do, and they make it worse. The rhythm goes. They shoehorn in all the information they can think of. That happens with speech writing a lot. It's a little bit like the difference between a C grade at A level and an A grade at A level. The C grade student just splurges everything they know. Then they get some marks for that because it shows that they've studied. But they don't actually answer the exam question, which is what the A student does. This happens in professional speech writing all the time. You write a speech that tells a story, and then everyone weighs in and says, "No, you've got to mention this, got to mention that." And all of a sudden, it's just a list. And yeah, I'm sick of writing for other people. I'm sick of being a ghostwriter, sick of being a backroom person. I don't believe I belong in the shadows. I believe I belong in the spotlight. But the complication now is I'm not quite sure what stage I want to be on. Is it a music stage? Is it a stand-up comedy stage? Is it something else? So I'm going to fly some kites, I think, and try different things. The other thing that's normally a factor when someone is unhappy is relationship status. Not a very politically correct thing to say, but anyone with an ounce of sense knows that the driving motivation for most people is to find a life partner who they think will make them happy. That is overwhelmingly what people want. The massive, massive majority of people want that. Jordan Peterson is absolutely right that what women tend to want is a competent male. And men want to meet someone as well. And of course, that's true if you're whether you're heterosexual or homosexual or bisexual. So I'm not clear really how much I feel a sense of loss about that side of things. I think as I've emerged a bit from the OCD and thinking more about actual real life than the OCD, that I'm gaining an awareness that this is something I'm sad about. There is a sense of loneliness. Again, no jealousy. I don't resent the people in my life who have got someone. I really don't. A very close member of my family has said to me, "There's nothing Pollyanna-ish about you," and I think that's a fair comment. I'm going to pat myself on the back on that one. I delight in other people's happy relationships. I think that's great. And there's part of me that sort of would like the freedom to travel and move around and kind of do things on my own terms. But of course, that doesn't actually preclude a relationship. And yeah, there are other more specific, more person-specific reasons I'm feeling down about this at the moment, I think. It's fair to say. That's all part of life, of course. Yeah, that's a funny thing, you know, when... I think I have a sort of understanding that there are some things that are just going to happen. There's some bad stuff that's just going to happen. I guess one of the things about the OCD is I do sort of feel I shouldn't have had to put up with that, man. I shouldn't have had to have that. Whereas when you lose loved ones, it's awful, but I think it's rare that you would feel if they're not your generation or a generation or two below, but if they're older than you and they've come and had a long life, I think there is a sort of feeling that, well, man, this is tough, but that's the deal. You know, your loved ones die as they get older. That's going to happen. It's really, really hard. And I think I've said before, something can be shocking, even if it's not a surprise, but you'd be pretty full of yourself if you felt hard done by that should happen. Even if those things cause more upset, they maybe don't frustrate maybe as much as the things where you think, no, it shouldn't be like that. And I think I do sort of feel that I shouldn't have to wait a hugely long time before I've got a physique I'm reasonably happy with. I shouldn't be alone. I shouldn't have had to battle with OCD. But of course, we all have things like that. We all have things that seem unfair. And I think one of the things about life and about a happy life is understanding that it won't always be fair. The notion that it's going to, and that's a notion that, you know, can dominate in films and TV, and it dominates political thought, the notion that life should be fair. I mean, that is a fantasy. Doesn't mean we shouldn't make strides to try and make it more fair. But that is certainly something which can cause enormous trouble and difficulty when people demand complete fairness. That's a chimera. And, you know, I've had to kind of come to terms with the fact that I have got OCD. It's a question of managing it. It's not a question of it waking up one day and it having gone away. Being overweight is a massive, massive challenge, but it's not cancer. And I haven't got diabetes. I'm actually in very good condition for a man who's so heavy. And so, you know, I can make the strides, I can reverse all this, and it's still not too late. I was never going to be a national hunt jockey. I was never going to be a footballer. Nothing's too late. It's not too late to have a wife and kids if that's what I want to do. It's a big challenge, but it's doable. And the same with the career stuff. You know, when I look at all this rationally, there's time to turn it around. It's all still there for the taking. And in the meantime, I guess I've just got to feel I'm making strides in the right direction, because that's what you have to do with every big task. You have to say, okay, well, let's just get started and let's feel that we're accomplishing it piece by piece. And you go on a journey and you may have to tack a bit. That's something a brilliant friend of mine who's a life coach has talked to me about. You need to tack sometimes. You need to move from side to side. It isn't always straight ahead. But that's okay too. At least you're in the boat. And that gives you a fighting chance to get across those choppy seas. I think some of the melancholy is a physiological thing as well. Another reason to refine one's diet's not just to lose weight, it's also to have a clear head. I wish that I had learned when I was much younger how good exercise is for mental health. Everyone said it. Didn't believe it. Just didn't believe it. And I now realise it's true. Just like I now realise that women like funny men. Again, something I just didn't believe. But, yeah. Life can be tough, you know. life can be really tough. And when we look back at previous generations and how they didn't seem to have these problems, this navel gazing, this depression and all of that kind of stuff, let's not kid ourselves, they did have it. They did have it. And they didn't cope with it. What do people think was going on with alcoholics? What does people think was going on with people who are violent? We've had dysfunctional people. We've always had them. We've always had them. We've had damaged people. As just something that we didn't acknowledge. We've had soldiers with post-traumatic stress disorder. It wasn't called that. It was called shell shock. But my God, it's existed. It's always existed. It remains a Cinderella service, though, in our National Health Service, our absurdly venerated, fetishized National Health Service, which any comprehensive study of competing health systems across the world very much places as a mediocre health service. The idea that we have a really good one is a fantasy. There are people in it who are fantastic. People at all levels. Doctors, nurses, and yes, some managers, the reviled managers, they're not all bad by any means. But the system itself is hopeless in many ways, as well as really good at some things. And one of those ways is mental health. Absolutely dreadful. Do not interact with the NHS without being really careful if you have OCD. I would really caution against it. They are dreadful and will do you active harm. Seek out someone who knows what they're doing. As my experience of the NHS tells me, an NHS doctor is not likely to. And if it means paying a bit of money to go private, that's well worth it. Get some good books. Get Brain Lock by Jeffrey Schwartz and You Are Not Your Brain by Jeffrey Schwartz and work through the programs that he advocates if you've got OCD. Don't think that a doctor is going to be any good. You might find that mental health nurses are very kind and that they are helpful. I found nurses much better than doctors. And this, you know, this is my last interaction with them on all this kind of stuff was over a decade ago, so things could have improved, but I doubt it. Yeah, so not really an upbeat podcast, this one, but an honest one. A searingly honest one. I think I've managed to work through a few things. I'm aware that people who love me listen to this, and I do want to just say this. I'm feeling a bit blue, but I'm not feeling terrible. And I am not feeling remotely suicidal. And I know this because I have felt suicidal in the past. And those feelings have gone. There is no question of me taking my own life. No question of that whatsoever. And, you know, I think part of my sadness and my frustration is that I know life can be so much better. And so that's what I'm going to focus on, making it happen, getting a good night's sleep, eating in a way that gives me the most energy possible, trying not to sweat the small stuff, making a very deliberate effort to reduce stress, probably trimming a few acquaintances from my circle. Because I've got really good friends and family I hardly ever see. I don't really have time for acquaintances unless I want them to be bumped up to friendship status. And if it's someone I want to get to know better, that's a bit different. But yeah, no, people who are never going to be here or there, really, in terms of me caring that much about them, I'm not going to spend too much time on them. And you shouldn't either. If there's someone in your life who's toxic or someone in your life who you know, just know, is never going to be a good friend one day, then kick him to the curb. You might be surprised, though. There are some really good friends in my life who I didn't much care for when I first met them. Either found them dull or even, in the odd case, actively disliked them. And, they're very, very dear friends to me now. So you can surprise yourself sometimes. Give yourself the space to do that as well. But, you know, if someone's just a meh kind of person, let alone if they're actively toxic, then I wouldn't spend any time with them. In fact, I'd make a point of avoiding them. Because you're going to die one day. And life is precious, and life is fragile, and life is finite. And so you've got to do what you've got to do to be happy. And don't feel guilty about that. Don't feel guilty about pursuing happiness. Not in the hedonistic sense. I'm talking about actual happiness, contentment, as well as ecstatic pleasure. You do that, you don't need to feel guilty. I don't have any angst whatsoever about the prospect of leaving public service in order to be some sort of entertainer. I don't feel that that would be a step down morally in any way whatsoever. If you can make people smile, if you can make them laugh, if you can touch them emotionally through a piece of art, you've done something really, really useful. One of my best moments doing stand-up was in Edinburgh, and there was a couple, middle-aged couple in the audience, and I don't know why, but I looked at them and thought they're just not going to really dig what I do. But it turned out that they did, and afterwards, Northern Irish couple, and the woman came up to me and said, I really like that, and I don't like comedy, which I took as a big compliment. Some people would have thought that was an insult or a backhanded compliment somehow, but I think I knew what she meant, and I sort of feel the same. I don't really like comedy either, by which I mean I don't like much mainstream comedy. And I really appreciated that and thanked her, and she left. And she got out the bar we were in, where the gig was, and then she came back in. So she'd left the building, and then she came back in, and she walked up to me and said, "Yeah, you know, you've really cheered me up. Thank you. Thank you very much." That was a humbling moment. That was a very humbling moment. I think reading between the lines, you must have had some pretty unpleasant experience. Maybe a traumatic one, or maybe, you know, she was feeling a bit like me and just kind of fundamentally dissatisfied with her life. And to be told that I'd taken her out of that and made her feel happy and given her a good laugh. That was fantastic. But that isn't just a quality that you'll find in comedy. If you are the best version of yourself, and the best version, being the best version of yourself, requires you to pursue your own happiness. Not only to do that, that's not the whole ball game. You've got to be kind as well. You've got to be honest. You've got to be just. You've got to think about other people. You've got to not think about yourself all the time. You've got to do things for other people. You've got to do boring things for other people, etc., etc., etc. A necessary but not sufficient condition of being the best version of yourself is to pursue your own happiness. And, you know, I think a great many of us are not happy because we know that there's something that we want to be doing and we're not doing it. You know, whether it's losing weight, whether it's giving up smoking, whether it's making a career change that we know we want. And I got to tell you, you know, if you don't do that, you probably won't be happy. I remember seeing Martin Sheen being interviewed by Jonathan Ross and saying he realised when he was very young that he had to be an actor, that, you know, he wasn't going to be happy if he didn't do it. And I think that's right. I think that's right. I'm not here to tell you that, you know, this is all about Zen. It's all about being happy with what you've got. And you can be just as happy being an office clerk as you would be if you were a rock star, if music's in your blood and you love rock music and you want to be a rock star, because it's not true. You won't be. You won't be. And you should never feel obliged to make that sort of sacrifice. You've got to pursue your happiness. And yeah, you need to have an income. You need to be able to support yourself. Absolutely right. And it may be that your career won't go the way you want it to. But with all of these careers, you do them because you want to do the thing. You do them because you want to do the thing. You play music because you love music. That's what a rock star is. It's someone who's really good at playing music. You don't become a rock star with no love for music. You don't become a professional footballer without loving football. And, yeah, it is better to be are not that good footballer than not be a footballer at all if you love football. So I can't promise you fame and fortune and success. Although I think you're actually, this is another point, the supposedly economically conservative choice is often not a very good idea. If you have a passion, then, and it's a real passion, a genuine passion that animates you totally, then you probably do have good potential at that kind of thing. And you probably will earn more money. You'll probably earn more money. The jobs I've taken because I played it safe and not really believed in myself, they haven't earned me the kind of money I'd have made by pursuing the things I wanted to do. Not just if I'd had roaring success in those things, but even moderate success in those things would have earned me more money. If you're the best version of yourself, you're going to earn a lot more money than if you're not, if you're doing something where you're pretending. There's a great commencement speech at some university somewhere in Asia by Jim Carrey. You can find it, probably just by typing Jim Carrey commencement speech into the YouTube search function, and he talks about his dad, who he says was the funniest man he ever met, which, given who Jim Carrey is himself and who he's worked with, is quite a compliment. But he played it safe and became, I think, an accountant. And then he got made redundant. So it didn't even turn out to be a safe move. And he said, you know, it would have been far better if he'd failed as a comedian than failed as an accountant. He'd have been happier. And, I am in a very privileged position. I'm not having to support a family. And, my overheads are small. So I'm in a position to start taking a few risks. But it's so true that the greatest risk is not going for what you want. And we exist on different planes. You know, you can be happy in certain aspects of your life. I know people who are really happily married, but not satisfied in their career. And it matters to them, even though the thing that matters to them most is going well. That's the thing. You know, yeah, for most of us, a happy family life does trump a good career. And so you think if you've got the main thing that you wouldn't care at all about the secondary thing, but that isn't true. It's certainly not true of most men. Most men really want a satisfying career, including people who don't appear to be ambitious. A close family member of mine might have been seen as unambitious. He was a brilliant teacher, and he could have been a headmaster at a top school, and he could have climbed all sorts of ladders, and he didn't want to. That looks like a lack of ambition, but it wasn't. Because his great ambition was to be a brilliant father and also to be a brilliant teacher. And of course, the more you get promoted in teaching, the less teaching you do. It's one of those ironies. So sometimes what looks like a lack of ambition is anything but. Because you've got to decide for yourself what your version of success is, what success looks like for you. Only you can know that. And it may be something that earns you less money than what you're currently doing. It may be. It absolutely may be. There's a friend of mine who was really into a radio presenter, a guy called Neil Bortz, who talked about how important it was to do long hours and how winners drive home in the dark. I don't think winners drive home in the dark at all. That doesn't sound like winning to me. I think winners knock off at 5 on the dot. Don't do a scrap of work for which they're not paid. And go and take a beautiful girl out for dinner. Or go home and play with their kids. You know? So your version of success may look and seem very different to someone else's. And the flip side is also the case. It may be that you do want to absolutely devote the bulk of your life to your career. And as long as you don't lie to people and, you know, have your spouse do all the work, bringing out the kids and, you know, make promises that you break and all of that, then, yeah, go for that. That's fine. But if you're not hurting people, then you're doing nothing wrong by pursuing your happiness, and it will mean that you can be the best version of you. And only you can determine what it is, and I don't know whether we're put on the earth to do specific things. I do know that we're better placed to work out for ourselves what it is we want to do than other people are. There's a caveat to that, which is that sometimes other people see in us qualities we didn't know we had. Fred Thompson, the actor, lawyer, and US senator who ran for the Republican nomination for president, kind of sank without trace, which disappointed me. He looked like he might be quite an interesting candidate, but I did really like his announcement video, and he said that when he was growing up, other people saw in him qualities that he hadn't recognised in himself. So do listen to people who you know have your best interests at heart. And you might be surprised to spot something in you that you hadn't seen for yourself. Also, do that for other people. Encourage other people. I spent 45 minutes basically talking about myself. But for me, you find yourself by losing yourself. You've got to do some strategizing. You've got to be honest with yourself about how you feel. That's all true. And you've got to work hard. And you've got to carve out time for yourself. That's all true. But what's also true is that you'll be a lot happier and a better person and make the world a better place if you look out for other people and really, really make an effort. I will never monetize something which I do as a pleasure and something which I get a lot of satisfaction from doing, which is connecting people. I've always thought I'd be terrible at public affairs, and I think I would be really bad at various aspects of it, but I am actually quite good at connecting people. People who will get on and will be able to help each other with career things. I've done that quite a lot in my life, and I get a real buzz from it. I get a real, real buzz from it, and a real buzz from taking time to give people advice. This is all now starting to sound like a humble brag. I don't want to exaggerate the amount that I've done it. But the danger of never saying anything that could look like bragging is that you can fail to give people good advice about what's a good way to live your life. And it just is the case that trying to think more about other people, trying to think about how I can give them a boost to their confidence, how I can spot things in them that they hadn't seen in themselves, how I can put them in touch with someone who they can work with and do well and do good things with. It's important to say that that has really been good for me. It's been good for my Amoir prop. And it being an advantage to me isn't the priority. But if it was, I would maintain the same strategy, rather like Sherlock Holmes's father in the version of Sherlock Holmes called Elementary, American TV series, with Johnny Lee Miller as Sherlock Holmes and Lucy Liu as Joan Watson. Brilliant, brilliant version of Sherlock Holmes. I highly commend it to you. His father, who's something of a villain, is tremendously powerful because of his ability to connect people in that way. A service for which he never charges. But he does come back at a later date asking for favours in return. I must say, if my approach to all this was mercenary, I would do that. I'd never charge a fee for connecting people. It's much, much better to hope that it will come back to you in the form of a favour. It isn't why I do it, but I hope there'll be an element of karma, if you like, about that. And I think that's a reasonable hope. And I guess, yeah, maybe I've sometimes been burned because I feel I've kind of made efforts to try and seek out opportunities for people, and fewer people have made the effort to do that in return. People who I think could have done. People who could have connected me with, people in various industries in which I wanted to work have not done so. Which is not to say that no one's ever done that, and there may well be people listening who are thinking, hang on, I did help Tom with this, and yes, you did, and I'm very grateful, thank you. But it's a good thing to do. It's a good thing to do. My whole concept, really, of life is based on the importance of the individual. It has absolutely dictated my political philosophy and what I would pompously call my moral philosophy. And my whole kind of concept of life is rooted in this notion that individuals are each unique and each indivisible and each have inherent value. That Kantian categorical imperative that we are an ends in ourselves and not a means to an end, that I believe absolutely. But I also believe that man is a social animal and that we can't hope to thrive in a hermit-like existence. It's one of the reasons I just totally reject philosophies that are all about navel gazing, that are all about the internal life of the mind. You know, I never wanted to be an academic. That's kind of one of the last things I'd ever want to do with my life. That's sort of my idea of hell, actually. Just poring over books endlessly, or being a hermit, or being a Trappist monk. You are not the best version of yourself if you just retreat into yourself. I promise you that that is not the way to lead your life. No way is that the best way to be. For the overwhelming majority of us, not all of us, but the overwhelming majority of us, a loving sexual relationship should be a core part of our life. For a sizable chunk of us, being a parent is going to be a necessary condition for being the best version of ourselves. It's not true for everyone. And people who don't want kids often are really ashamed to admit it. And not everyone is blessed with kids. And not everyone should have kids. But for most of us, that's going to be part of a life well lived. We should be kind to our family. We need to have friends. We should be pillars of our communities. Community in the actual proper meaning of the word, which is based on physical locations. That is vital. And if you want to be happy and if you want to be good, if you want to be as good as you can conceivably be, then you need to do that. You need to look outwards and you need to spend time with other people and you need to have a lot of time where you're not really thinking about yourself very much at all. And that's good for you. It's not just good for other people. That is good for you. I tried meditation when I was desperately trying to get over the OCD and handle intrusive thoughts. And my God, it just made things so much worse. If you're having thoughts you don't want, if you're feeling down, the last thing for me that you want to do is just sort of sit quietly and be contemplative. Absolutely not. What you want to do is pick up a guitar and work out how to play a song or watch a good movie or lose yourself in a good book or phone up a friend and say, how are you doing? And actually wait to hear the answer and then ask them some follow-up questions. The most powerful examples of grace I think I've ever encountered have been when seeing bereaved people, including a friend who lost his child at the age of 12. And the first time I saw him after that happened, he asked me how I was. And he actually wanted to know. He actually wanted an answer to that question. How are you, Tom? How have you been? That's humbling. There's nothing he could have said, really, that I would have objected to. There's nothing he could have not said that I would have objected to. You know, in that early period after that happened, I'd have cut him all the slack in the world. But yeah, in fact, he wants to know how I was. And yeah, and that's happened to me a bit on other occasions as well. You know, speaking to people who are terminally ill, who ask me how I am. And that is just so admirable. And on top of that, it's also a good strategy for them, even in their darkest hours. It's good for them to be thinking about other people. I don't mean that they were not being altruistic and they weren't genuinely interested and that it was all a sort of calculation. I don't mean that at all, but the happy fact is that the grace and the goodness that led them to behave in that way was actually good for them too, and that's a really special and important thing. I often wondered how I would ever get through an Edinburgh show and do 55 minutes on stage, just talking non-stop, how I'd ever remember the material, how I could ever talk for that length of time. Well, I probably haven't made you laugh very much, but we've gone over 55 minutes, and I think probably it's time to stop now. But thanks for listening. If you've made it all the way through this, then I think you're not just an audience member, you're a survivor, and it's been quite an endurance feat for you probably, but I hope it's been provocative in a good way, and yeah, don't worry about me, I'm going to be fine, and you're going to be fine too. Lots of love. This is Eclectic Waffle. You were listening to Eclectic Waffle. Join us next time when I hope I'll be a bit less self-indulgent and a bit funnier. Bye for now.